Today is Wednesday, the 4th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. China says it will test the entire population of Wuhan, the city that is believed to be the origin of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Wuhan had reported no local coronavirus cases since May 2020.
It comes as the WHO says many African countries have yet to vaccinate 1% of their populations against the coronavirus as outbreaks intensify across the continent. We'll have these stories and more next. The Chinese city of Wuhan will test all of its 12 million residents for the coronavirus, officials said on Tuesday, after the place where the coronavirus emerged in late 2019 confirmed its first domestic cases of the highly transmissible Delta variant. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi starts us off.
Wuhan had reported no local coronavirus cases since May 2020, but on Monday, authorities confirmed three new cases of the Delta variant. The vice director of Hubei's Provincial Disease Control Center says these were linked to infections found in Huaiyang City in Jiangsu province. The outbreak in Jiangsu is believed to have begun in the provincial capital of Nanjing, with the Delta variant most likely introduced on a flight from Russia, according to officials. Since then, numerous cities in southern China and a few in the north, including Beijing, have reported infections. But it was not immediately clear if all of these cases were of the Delta variant or if they were all linked to Nanjing, as some authorities have not disclosed conclusive results of their virus tracing efforts. The Delta variant poses new risks for the world's second biggest economy as it spreads from the coast to inland cities. Authorities in numerous cities have launched mass testing to identify and isolate carriers.
Maha Albadrawi of Reuters News. The U.S. southeastern state of Florida has once more broken a record for COVID-19 hospitalizations. Associated Press correspondent Shelley Adler is up next.
According to data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the number of people hospitalized for COVID-19 in Florida rose to an all-time high of just over 11,500. But Florida Governor Ron DeSantis would like to stress the lack of fatalities due to the number of seniors that are vaccinated.
Even amidst a lot of positive tests, you know, you still see much less mortality than we did year over year.
And he adds surges like these come and go.
It will probably come back in the winter just like last year, not as much as the Northeast, but we'll see.
Hospitals around the state have reported a noticeable drop in age of the COVID-19 patients. I'm Shelley Adler.
With worries of a sharp increase of COVID-19 infections overwhelming the country's hospitals, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced on Tuesday that only seriously ill coronavirus patients, or those at risk of becoming so, will be admitted for treatment. Others infected with COVID-19 will have to isolate at home in order to try to make sure that there are enough hospital beds available. Japan is adding about 10,000 new cases per day, prompting the head of the Japan Medical Association to call on Tuesday for a nationwide state of emergency. The World Health Organization also said it's important to closely watch the changes in the virus that could be more resistant to drugs and vaccines, and for more genomic sequencing of COVID-19 tests for tracking and studying. The WHO says many African countries have yet to vaccinate 1% of their populations against COVID-19 as outbreaks intensify across the continent. This while other wealthier countries have immunized their most vulnerable citizens, stockpiled jabs to prepare for the possibility of a third round of vaccinations. The WHO says Africa simply doesn't have the means to buy sufficient COVID-19 shots fast enough, and many thousands of lives are being lost because of so-called vaccine inequity. Darren Taylor has more.
The epidemiologist in charge of South Africa's scientific response to the pandemic, Barry Shoup, says there are good reasons to give a third vaccine dose to people with weaker immune systems.
So this would be people with undercurrent illnesses or people on various treatments for cancer, for example, illnesses such as HIV and so on, where they're not responding as well to the normal two doses of Pfizer, for example. So a booster dose is being considered to actually, again, stimulate the immune system to get an immune response.
But, like the WHO, many scientists believe it's in the world's best interests to make sure all vulnerable people around the globe have received at least one jab before any move is made toward third shots. They say it may be morally questionable for richer countries to buy millions of doses, while poorer regions, such as Africa, struggle for supplies. But such stockpiling has a scientific basis.
These are excellent vaccines, let's make no mistake about it. They've radically reduced severe disease, which really is the main aim at this stage of vaccination. So they're very good vaccines. But on the other hand, they're not as good as, for example, measles vaccine is one example, or polio, or any of those vaccines, which give very long-lasting, sometimes even lifelong immunity.
Shoub says it's impossible to say how long the available vaccines will protect against serious COVID-19.
But eventually we feel that that immunity is going to decay. Now, at this stage, it's too early to know how frequently we're going to need boosters in healthy individuals. It may be annually, maybe every 2 years, every 5 years. We don't know at this stage. I think we can be pretty confident that we will need boosters at a future time.
He says, again, wealthier nations are buying all the different vaccines available based on current scientific knowledge.
There has been some evidence of some mixing of vaccines, which does have an advantage. Now, whether it's going to be that or whether the vaccines will need to be tweaked, I think they will need to be tweaked. Remember, we're only now in our first generation of vaccines. There will be improvements of vaccines as the science of vaccines develops.
Health activists say these improvements will result in richer countries dumping their original vaccines on Africa in the future. Shoub says the world's also going to need a lot more different vaccines because COVID-19's constantly mutating and throwing up new variants, making it unlikely for populations to ever achieve so-called herd immunity.
These variants occur in individuals who don't respond that well and where the virus continues to multiply. And as the virus multiplies, it's got more chance of being selected to escape the immunity. So it's not going to be that the population's immune. That's really the way that we have to deal with the virus, to stop it multiplying in individuals and to get as many people immunized as quickly as possible. That's really the aim.
Right now, says the WHO, that's far from being achieved in Africa, where life-saving vaccines remain rare. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A Belarusian activist has been found dead in Kyiv, and Ukrainian police are treating it as murder. Vitaly Shishov led a Kyiv-based organization that helped exiled Belarusians. Reuters' Lucy Fielder takes it from here.
Vitaly Shishov was reported missing by his partner on Monday when he didn't come home from a run. Ukraine, Poland, and Lithuania have become havens for Belarusians. During a crackdown by President Alexander Lukashenko following a disputed election last year, Shishov led the Belarusian House in Ukraine group, which says it helps Belarusians find accommodation, jobs, and legal advice. His colleague said in a statement he'd felt under constant surveillance since he left Belarus last year, after taking part in anti-government protests, adding that he was warned about possible threats, including being kidnapped or killed. Shishov had treated these risks with stoicism and humour, the Belarusian House said. The Belarusian authorities have characterised anti-government protesters as criminals or violent revolutionaries backed by the West, and described the actions of law enforcement agencies as appropriate and necessary.
Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder. The United Nations accuses the government of Iraq of the widespread torture of detainees held in the country's detention centres. A UN report covers conditions in the centers from July 1st of 2019 to April 30th of 2021. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Torture and ill treatment are prohibited under international law. Iraq ratified the International Convention Against Torture in 2011 and since has enacted national laws criminalizing torture. The problem is the government has not implemented the procedural safeguards to prevent torture, and so the practice continues throughout the country. That assessment, in a report released Tuesday by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN assistance mission for Iraq is based on interviews that the authors conducted with 235 people deprived of their liberty. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says more than half of those interviewed provided accounts of having been tortured or ill-treated while in custody. She says some detainees described beatings by officers with metal pipes or of being shocked with exposed electrical wires. One inmate, she says, spoke of having his handcuffs hooked on a chain and hung from the ceiling.
The report states that legal procedures designed to bring interrogations and detention under judicial control within 24 hours of the initial arrest are not respected. And access to a lawyer is systematically delayed until after suspects have been interrogated by the security forces.
Hurtado says torture is used to extract confessions and access to a lawyer is systematically delayed until after suspects have been interrogated by security forces. She says the location of 17 official detention sites remains opaque.
The report also raises concerns that the authorities ignore complaints and signs of torture and says that the system established to address official complaints appear to be neither fair not effective. The report also says that the limited accountability for such failures on the part of the authorities suggests acquiescence and tolerance of these practices.
The report calls on Iraqi authorities to put the nation's anti-torture legal framework fully in line with international human rights law, particularly the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Commenting on the report, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the prevention of torture, and not just on paper, would contribute to peace and stability in the long term. Bachelet adds such an outcome is in the interest of the state as well as the victims. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France hopes to secure more than $350 million in humanitarian aid for Lebanon's crisis-battered population. It made the announcement ahead of a donors conference it co-hosts with the United Nations on Wednesday, marking the year anniversary of Beirut's deadly port blast. Lisa Bryant reports that international pressure is growing for Lebanon's fractious parties to unify and push through reforms.
Roughly 40 representatives of international institutions and heads of state were expected at this video conference, including U.S. President Joe Biden and Jordan's King Abdullah. It marks the third international meeting Paris has hosted this past year to support ordinary Lebanese struggling under deepening poverty and spiraling inflation and unemployment. The World Bank calls Lebanon's political and financial crisis since 2019, the world's worst since the mid-19th century. Co-hosted by the UN, Wednesday's virtual talks come exactly a year after the massive explosion of fertilizer stocked at Beirut's port, which killed more than 200 people, injured thousands, and devastated big chunks of the capital. International frustration is growing over Lebanon's squabbling political parties. Lebanon's new prime minister-designate, billionaire businessman Najib Mikati, said he was unable to form a new government before the blast anniversary. His predecessor, Saad Hariri, gave up efforts to do so.
La France, surtout, mais aussi les autres États donateurs,
Hasni Abidi, international relations professor at the University of Geneva, said France and other donor nations cannot invest in Lebanon in a sustainable way so long as there is no government willing to engage in real reforms demanded by the international community. Apparently, to ramp up pressure on Lebanon's parties, the European Union announced it had adopted a legal framework for sanctioning individuals and entities seen as undermining the country's rule of law and democracy. Before the EU framework was announced, a European Union spokeswoman said it was too soon to talk about specifics in terms of sanctions. Former colonial power France has played a leading role in mobilizing international backing for struggling Lebanese and in prodding the country's politicians. French President Emmanuel Macron was the first foreign leader to visit Beirut after the 2020 blast. Days later, he held a first international funding conference and another this past June to support Lebanon's financially strapped army. Some critics suggest France has little to show for its efforts thus far and should have imposed tough sanctions against Lebanon's political elite early on. Others say it's up to Lebanon's politicians to act. Otherwise, they say there is little the international community can do. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
More than 2 years after the collapse of its self-declared caliphate, the Islamic State terror group appears to be trying to rebuild its army in the eastern Syrian desert on the backs of boys and teenagers, many smuggled out of displaced persons camp that dot Syria's northeast. The revelation is based on U.S. military intelligence and part of a report that was issued on Tuesday by the U.S. Defense Department's Inspector General on American and Allied operations in Syria and Iraq. The report warned that despite a series of crackdowns by U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, IS retains significant influence in many of the camps, as well as freedom of movement, allowing it to target the most susceptible for recruitment. U.S. military officials further warned the Al-Hol displaced persons camp in particular has been a hotbed for IS recruitment and radicalization. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Authorities in Cameroon say there are increasing numbers of Boko Haram militants surrendering and flooding disarmament centers on the northern border with Nigeria. Officials say that there have been hundreds of defections from the terrorist group since May, when Abubakar Sakau, the leader of the Islamist group, was declared killed. Moki Edwin Kinzika has those details.
Dieudonné Nkuluzanga is one of the administrators of the DDR center in Meri. He says the center received more than 155 militants within the past 7 days, and a total of about 450 militants have arrived at the center since May.
Nous avons reçu l'espace pour la construction d'un centre multifonctionnel d'environ 1,500.
Zanga says the government of Cameroon has provided space in Meme, another northern town not far from Nigeria, for the construction of a center that can host 1,500 former Boko Haram fighters. He says funds to construct the DDR center are available and construction work will begin soon. Zanga said the center in Meri is small and cannot accommodate the increasing number of Boko Haram militants abandoning the group. DDR officials say a majority of the 155 militants who arrived this week are wives of the fighters and their children. 40 of the 57 men are former Boko Haram fighters. Francis Fayengo is director of the government's DDR center. He told reporters Monday that the government has taken adequate measures to provide for the needs of the former fighters. Speaking at a news conference in Yaoundé, Yenwo says Cameroon's President Paul Biya has instructed officials to pardon all fighters who surrender and disarm. He says a majority of the fighters who escape from the bush to join the DDR center need to detox from substance use. He says it is very difficult to communicate with the former Boko Haram combatants when the fighters are still struggling with substance use disorders. He says the former fighters confessed to their crimes, including killing, and should be admitted in the de-radicalization process as soon as possible. Yengo did not say how many weapons were collected from the fighters. However, Cameroon's military said the militants handed themselves to troops of the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin that is fighting the jihadist group. The task force is made up of troops from Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria.
Cameroon said the troops transported the militants who surrendered from border localities to the DDR center. A majority of the militants surrendered around Nigeria's Sambisa Forest, an area bordering Cameroon and a stronghold for Boko Haram. Saibu Issa is a conflict resolution specialist at the University of Marwa in Cameroon. He says many militants have been defecting following the death of Abubakar Shekau, the leader of Boko Haram, in May. Issa says attacks by the Joint Task Force in formerly Boko Haram-controlled areas and his fighters have made Shekau's militants weaker.
With the demise of Shekau, they were obliged to go in for predatory attacks, given the impression that they were just going in for survival attacks to make money around Lake Chad and be able to, let's say, be independent, at least concerning their daily life.
Issa said rival jihadist groups that disagree with Shekau also scare Boko Haram militants who fail to join the rival groups. He said the fighters who defect are either returning to their communities, handing themselves to the military, or regrouping to strategize and form a stronger jihadist group. In May, a video from Bakura Mutu, the presumed successor of Shekau, appeared to confirm that the Boko Haram leader was killed by rival jihadist groups in the Sambisa Forest in April. Although founded in 2002, Boko Haram gained more prominence after attacks against authorities in northeastern Nigeria in 2009. And in 2014, it spread into neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Over 30,000 people have been killed and 2 million have been displaced due to the conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News. Yaoundé, Cameroon.
An investigation has found that New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women inside and outside of the state government. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
New York Attorney General Letitia James made the announcement Tuesday.
The independent investigation has concluded that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women and in doing so violated federal and state law.
June Kim, one of the lawyers leading the investigation, says there were 11 women sexually harassed by the governor. One of them was on his security detail.
Some suffered through unwanted touching and grabbing of their most intimate body parts.
Investigators spoke with 179 people, including the governor, who they say acknowledged some of the interactions but has publicly denied any sexual harassment. Julie Walker, New York.
In a televised statement, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says he's been touching, kissing, and hugging all kinds of people for decades, a habit that has been misinterpreted.
I've been making the same gesture in public all my life. I actually learned it from my mother and from my father. It is meant to convey warmth. Nothing more.
U.S. Senate Republicans blocked a vote on a major package of Democratic voting rights reforms earlier this summer. The move was part of a broader state-by-state battle between the two parties over revamping election laws following the 2020 presidential election. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson explains, Republicans are calling for safeguards on election integrity, while Democrats want to expand access for voters.
The bitter fight over election reform arrived at Congress's front door, where more than 50 Texas Democrats gathered after fleeing their state to prevent passage of a Republican bill they said severely restricted voting for minorities in the wake of the 2020 election.
Trump lost the election.
Since former President Donald Trump insisted without proof the election was rigged against him, 17 states have passed 28 laws with new restrictions on voting. And in July, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a key decision giving states broader powers to impose restrictions on voting. Advocates say the Democrats' legislation bottled up in the Senate would eliminate many of those restrictions.
The For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act will actually look for ways to modernize how we do our elections and then also to make sure that marginalized groups who have been discriminated against historically are able to vote.
Senate Democrats have so far struggled to pass those bills, even as the Biden administration has vowed to keep fighting.
This is about the American people's right to vote, unfettered. It is about their access to the right to vote in a meaningful way. Because nobody is debating, I don't believe, whether all Americans have the right to vote. The issue here is there actual access to the voting process.
But with only a slim majority, Democrats have no chance of securing the 10 Republican votes needed in the Senate to pass legislation. Republicans want the states to support more rigorous voter identification and ballot security measures.
These measures are designed to provide order and secure the elections and provide confidence in the results.
And conservative analysts argue elections should not be regulated from Washington, D.C.
The states are each responsible for running their elections. This bill, H.R. 1, which Democrats are urging Congress to pass, would lead to a federal takeover of the administration of elections across the country. It has many other changes like that that, in essence, get rid of the kind of basic security and safety protocols and measures that states put in place to try to safeguard the integrity and security of the election process.
But Democrats are hopeful public opinion is on their side, arguing that the voting rights reforms they advocate will help hold the government accountable.
If you just poll people across the nation, Republicans and independents and Democrats, they all want to take on gerrymandering. They all want to take on dark money that allows billionaires and corporations to buy elections. They all want to protect the ballot box as the pulsating heart of our republic.
Civil rights leaders are calling for thousands to march on the nation's capital on August 28th to keep the pressure on lawmakers to pass those reforms. Yeah. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Are the Tokyo Games the greenest ever Olympics? Here's how Tokyo 2020 is meeting its goal of being a beyond carbon neutrality event. Reuters' Rosanna Philpott rounds us out.
Are the Tokyo Games the greenest ever Olympics? From cardboard beds to absent fans, here's how Tokyo 2020 is meeting its goal of being a beyond carbon neutrality event. Hydrogen has been used in a variety of different ways instead of fossil fuels. It's being used to power the athletes' village, as well as light the Olympic cauldron and even the vehicles shuttling between venues. No fans, snack stands, tour buses or hotel bookings may seem like no fun, but to environmentalists, the pared-down approach is exactly what's needed in a world confronting climate change. Initially, the Tokyo Organizing Committee had estimated the mega event would result in CO2 emissions of some 2.73 million tons. For reference, that's more than what the cities of Vancouver or Melbourne emitted in all of 2019. But without the traveling crowds to feed, house and entertain, that carbon footprint will be cut by 12%. That's according to a sustainability report published by the organizers in July. Among the 43 venues for Olympics and Paralympics Games, 25 existed before the Games and 10 are temporary constructions, preventing the white elephant stadiums left behind in other host cities. This is one of them, the Village Plaza. The 40,000 pieces of timber were donated by Japanese municipal governments. After the Games, they'll be dismantled and returned for reuse in local facilities. Inside the athletes' village, the competitors even sleep on cardboard beds. This year's Olympic medals are made from old mobile phones and other small appliances donated by the general public. The initiative started back in 2017. And even the victory ceremony podiums they stand on were 3D printed from plastic waste.
So we collected recycled plastic waste equivalent to about 400,000 laundry detergent bottles from members of the public, donated by members of the public, as well as collected ocean plastic waste to create about 98 podiums to be used during the games at the victory ceremonies.
The Games will, however, rely on a carbon offset program to reach negative carbon output. More than 200 Japanese businesses are estimated to donate carbon credits of around 4.38 tons to the Games from July 2018 to September 2020, which will tip the event into the black. Organizers will publish final emissions figures after the Games.
Rosanna Philpott reports for Reuters News. This has been International Edition from the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.